Good morning, everyone. If we had not been discussing boycotts here on Wednesday night, and I'm glad we have been, one might have stumbled over a rally on the London South Bank by activists campaigning against, I quote, apartheid Israel. The aim of the protest was to convince the electropop duo Pet Shop Boys to cancel their concert in Tel Aviv, scheduled for next Sunday. Neil Tennant, part of the duo, explains why the event will take place anyway. He does not agree with the call to boycott Israel, but also indicates the country overdid it in terms of militarization. Referring to the music business, he countered the characterization of Israel as an apartheid state, and I quote, "In apartheid-era South Africa, artists could only play to segregated audiences. In Israel, anyone who buys a ticket can attend a concert." This is just one example of the opposing views in the ongoing debate about the BDS aim to boycott Israel and thereby change its policy. I would like to focus today on the apartheid analogy, as it is indeed a key concept for many organizations involved in the promotion of such a boycott. We have heard a little about it over the last few days. Israel's current state of affairs is compared to South Africa's situation when a white, respectively Afrikaans minority ruled over the rest of the people by a political regime of segregation of the four defined groups along an imagined race line and for various areas in life. While the comparison also hints at the settler history and a supposed colonialist approach of Jews migrating to Israel in the first half of the century at least, it predominantly stresses the alleged racism in Israel. The accusation of an apartheid-like situation in today's Israel does refer to either of two different groups. A, to non-Jewish Israeli citizens, and that means only exclusively in this context, to Arab Israelis. They're about 20% of the almost 7 million Israelis. Or else, the diagnosed apartheid refers to B, the Palestinians, who usually have no citizenship at all, i.e., they are stateless. Often it is unclear to which group a particular campaign refers to exactly. That is a problem because those two groups are treated very differently by the Israeli state. I will show why and how that matters in a moment. A second central problem with this analogy, Israel and South Africa apartheid, is the term racism and how it is used. An important difference is overlooked regularly. On the one hand, there is the state and its laws in which the government regulates how citizens as well as state agencies can and cannot act. This is particularly important in any constitutional state where any action and the laws themselves can be challenged on the basis of a constitution or an equivalent thereof. On the other hand, even if there was 100% equality on paper, there can still be racism, the kind of racism that exists in many societies on various levels and influences the way people think, speak, and act against others. Yet, it is not the day-to-day racism, but the official one that is relevant for such a label apartheid. It refers to a line drawn along the supposed ethnic line, and if and when this line is drawn by the state. To investigate the situation, let us first look at the situation of Israeli citizens with Arab background. Those Arabs living on what turned out to be Israel, i.e. those who were not expelled or asked to leave the territory by their community leaders, were given the citizenship of Israel, and their descendants were treated the same. It is clear that they are citizens of Israel, but has the assertion any substance that they are rather formally citizens? Is all they get a second-class citizenship? To show how they are claimed to be discriminated officially and willingly by the state, three areas of discrimination are mentioned regularly, and I chose those to just discuss the ones that I think matter most to the comparison. A, access to land, B, military service, and C, the possibilities and impossibilities of becoming an Israeli citizen. A couple of facts on the land matter. More than 90% of the land in Israel is owned by the state, administered by the Israeli Land Administration. It leases this land to Israelis. Now, the usual complaint in terms of discrimination is that the land is supposedly not leased to Arab Israelis. The truth is that this discrimination in leasing only refers to about 15% of this specifically administered land. This part is the property of the Jewish National Fund, an organization that from the late 19th century collected money in order to buy land for Jews in what today is Israel. The Israel Land Administration has managed this property for the Jewish National Fund since 1960. It was agreed then that the management of that part of the land would respect the rules of the fund, and that is not to lease to anyone but to Jews. So the state, in the name of a private organization, discriminates here. The Israeli High Court has ruled against it. Nonetheless, it seems to be practiced today. Yet, BDS campaigns not only criticize this discrimination, they often directly link this to the outcome of certain policies. The policy on housing, just as much as on education, benefits, and much more, has an effect that can be different to different groups. In a democracy, each citizen is treated equally, and that necessarily includes that the state disregards all particularities of people. By treating citizens equally, the state abstains from taking into consideration the existing and often material differences. In Israel, that is for instance, the much lower education level of an average Arab Israeli in comparison with Jewish Israelis. If the state wants to tackle that specifically, it can introduce measures against it. For instance, by specifically supporting poor people or regions, or taking measures of positive discrimination. Unless such policy is applied, the inequality between people will be reasserted or even increased exactly by equal treatment. You do not have to like that outcome, but it is nothing Israel in particular can really be blamed for, as it is a problem with the principle of equal treatment. From calling Israel an apartheid state is something very different than to say this is not a good situation and we should support certain groups more. The second point that is critiqued as a matter of official discrimination refers to the consequences of, and sometimes the fact that, Arab Israelis do not have an obligation to serve in the army. Arab Israelis are officially treated differently in that regard. Yet, as anybody is free to serve, it can hardly be understood as a disadvantage not to have to be ready to be killed and to kill. Most would disagree on the basis of the consequences of the military service. It is an important social networking factor for diverse situations in life, and it means access to funds for veterans. The first one is the social consequences. It is not a discrimination based on anything written in the law. Even more, any Arab who serves in the army is also part of that network. And a couple of years ago, a civil service scheme called National Service was introduced by the government, and that gives people the opportunity to serve, but to serve outside the military. The service includes benefits similar to the ones for veterans. Whereas the law, in this case, treats Jewish Israelis differently than Arab Israelis, and so does differentiate between different groups of citizens, the law itself cannot be argued to be to the disadvantage of Arab Israelis. It would rather be Jewish Israelis who are hit hard, as they have to serve in the army no matter if they want to. Another popular claim is the possibility of Jews to become Israeli citizens, yet no other people have that opportunity. The issue goes beyond equality of citizens, because it is a matter of who the state is interested to accommodate as possible citizens, so they're not citizens yet. No democratic state, in fact, treats those equal who are not or not yet citizens. As somebody from Botswana, there's hardly any chance to get, for example, a US passport. You have a few more chances when you come from the West with some green card lottery or a special skill. The German state, for example, looks for high-quality IT experts. Very particular refugees from very particular countries might be legally accepted, which often reflects a certain positive or negative interest vis-a-vis the refugee's home country. In short, it is not a violation of the equality of citizens when Israel chooses to consider some people in particular for its citizenship. It is indeed based on ethnic or religious criterion. But that certainly is no singularity. Germany, for example, opened its doors in the 90s for people with so-called German descent. Laws that do not directly discriminate against Arab Israelis are not racist laws. As shortly mentioned above, there are a number of laws that on average have more practical relevance for either Jewish or Arab Israelis. But that is a result of equal access to the law and is not thanks to them being racist themselves. And that is true for any democracy where racism, sexism, or other forms of discrimination play a role. Certain social roles, like landlords, owners of a company, or other high-ranking positions, are defined in the law, as they are defined in the law, are mostly taken on by white men with sufficient capital. This is because these structures exist, and they usually reaffirm these discriminations. But they do not include clauses to exclude Germans with Turkish background, Brits with Pakistani, or Israelis with Arab background. But this is the heart of the meaning of apartheid. Either you were white, then you had legal access to separated buses, jobs, beaches, and much more, or you had another background, and then you were headed to another world officially separated from the first one. Even though there is racism in Israel, indeed, it is a practical racism that exists all over in the West and the rest of the world. I can be short on this racism in Israel in general, however it is measured. In diverse statistics about the social, economic, educational situation, it is clear that Arab Israelis and some other groups too, on an average, have less access. One thing leads to the next. The smaller the income, for example, of Arab Israelis that they usually have, the lower the tax income for their municipality, which again means it can spend less on social services on the ground, and that again can be a big disadvantage. And there is the everyday racism in the way many people are treated in various situations. This is a bad position for anyone to be in, and it should be challenged. It is an even bigger problem than it sometimes seems reading BDS campaign material. Arab Israelis have not been granted a patent on being treated racistly. Ethiopian Jews suffer from it most obviously too, but there are other groups being targeted too. But all that does not provide for the verdict of apartheid. Germany, for example, also has a political culture of racism, and one can find strong racist attitudes in all other Western countries too. A completely different scenario presents itself for the Palestinians, those living in the Palestinian territories. First of all, there's no country whose citizens there are. Usually, Palestinians are stateless in terms of their legally recognized status. They live on a territory that Israel has conquered in a number of wars with Arab states, mainly from Jordan. Israel has the military control over the area since then. Yet, it is not simply Israeli territory. The status is disputed, not just internationally, but also within Israel. This also manifests itself in the political status of the area since the Oslo Agreement. There is a quasi-state with a Palestinian authority forming a quasi-government with part of the powers a fully sovereign state would have, i.e. no military, but part of the policing, for instance. Not only the return of the Sinai Peninsula in 1982 and the withdrawal from Gaza lately show that the disputed territories is very much reality. Depending on who is in power and what the respective government wants to accomplish, the territories are handled very differently. So even though Israel has been in military control over the territory since 1967, it does not mean it is Israeli national territory. And therefore, the residents in the territories are not Israeli citizens either. In a world of competing nation states, to just belong to a quasi-state means a lot more than the usual trouble for the affected people. The daily controls at the borders or within the territories at the checkpoints, the lack of access to one's land due to the security fence or wall, and many more. So does this status of non-citizens make the treatment by the Israeli state any better? No, it does not. Does it make Israel an apartheid state? No, it does not. The residents of the Palestinian territories are non-citizens to Israel, and non-citizens are treated very differently from citizens in every country of the world. Each report from an asylum seeker's hostel illustrates that barbarously. For all its particularities in terms of the settlements, the territory status being disputed, and more, it is a fact that Palestinians in the territories are not Israeli citizens, never have been, and to be honest, most of them by now would not want to be. It is not. This is one fact that is ignored by about any BDS activist simply in order to call Israel an apartheid state. It is this argument, too, that is central to Oren Yiftachel, who sees Israel not as a democracy, but as an ethnocracy, and who is cited a lot by various BDS proponents. He declares the Palestinian territories to be Israeli territory simply because, as he put it, Israel governs there. Just to note that he contradicts this when he holds against understanding Israel as a democracy that the borders were not clearly defined. By defining the Palestinian territories as the national territory of Israel, he can argue that Palestinians are illegitimately non-citizens within the country. This conclusion can only be drawn by ignoring the fact of the dispute over the land between Israel and the PA, as well as within Israel, i.e. its disputed status. For Israel proper, he is simply wrong, but that does not appear in his reasoning, nor does it appear in many papers and articles that claim Israel to be so much more like apartheid South Africa than like a Western democracy in all its specific concreteness. The call for an academic boycott surpasses all this. In the name of anti-apartheid, anti-racism, and of an alleged improvement of the lives of the Palestinians, it takes hostage all Israeli academics. It holds Israeli individuals accountable for their government's actions. Such a nationalist conclusion shows what some in the BDS are ready to do. They're ready to harm the life of some who are not at all necessarily involved in order to maybe gain something for others. Challenging a desperate situation on the one side by nationalist action against others who are not even directly responsible shows how little the boycott campaigners, at least of that tendency, are interested in those principles, like an improvement in the name of anti-racism, the ones they claim to fight for. To conclude, let's have a quick look at the bigger picture. First, any standard boycott campaign these days formulates its aims and looks for economic and other measures to harm those responsible for the targeted situation. Yet, there's no way of ensuring the effect is the one hoped for, and we had some examples during the conference. Sometimes even the opposite is reached. That does not at all have to be due to clumsy acting by the boycotters. It is due to the powers who enforce potential actions. Usually a company or a state or states are the entities being appealed to by boycotters. And they follow the states and companies, they follow their own principles and interests. As long as those are not analyzed and reflected in a way a campaign works, it is no wonder the process of what might be happening cannot be anticipated and sometimes goes terribly wrong. It does not come as a surprise either that BDS campaigns get support from fascists, like what happened recently in Germany. The boycott fits well with their own anti-Israel and anti-Semitic interests. Second, anything and everything can be criticized in the Middle East and anywhere else too. And the world presents more than enough reasons to criticize a lot indeed. To analyze the role of current anti-imperialism, often in combination with an ethnicizing anti-racism, of nationalism and of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, which all play a role in the BDS movement, That would be a contribution in another paper. But the aim of the comparison seems to be clear to me nevertheless. It's supposed to remind everyone of a successful struggle, as you also if you outlined, remind everyone of a successful struggle with a clear division of good and bad. In short, apartheid is bad, and no one could reasonably be in favor. To scandalize and distort the situation in the Middle East by means of a comparison that simply does not stand a fact check suggests that there's more at stake than the well-being of Palestinians, let alone the well-being of people in the Middle East in general. Thank you.